of journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just
a second.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Thursday, March 29th, 2012, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think.
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 Silence is not an option.
How ALEC proliferates Stand Your Ground laws nationwide. Slake Magazine's Joe Donnelly on All In for the 99%, and local Palestinian rights activists bring home the BDS campaign against the Israeli occupation, plus a commentary by Mumia Abu-Jamal.
This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. Illinois Congressman and former Black Panther Bobby Rush called for an end to racial profiling in the wake of Trayvon Martin's killing from the floor of the House of Representatives yesterday. During his comments, Rush took off his suit jacket and put on a gray hooded sweatshirt, after which he was interrupted by presiding Republican Congressman Greg Harper, who called the Illinois Congressman out of order for violating a no-hat rule.
Just because someone wears a hoodie does not make them a hoodlum. The Bible teaches us, Mr. Speaker, in the book of Micah 6:6-8,
the member will suspend.
These words,
the member will
these words. He has shown you, oh man,
the member will
what is good.
The chair must remind
what does not what does the Lord require of you?
Rush refused to stop speaking and was then ejected from the chamber. He later told CNN, "I don't mind being out of order if it means standing up for truth and justice." The February 26th killing of Trayvon Martin continues to be met with calls for the arrest of his shooter, George Zimmerman, and with the national solidarity movement against racial profiling. Martin's death has also brought scrutiny on Florida's Stand Your Ground law, which allows citizens to use deadly force in self-defense without retreating when they perceive a threat to their life. George Zimmerman claimed he shot Martin in self-defense, and the law puts the burden of proof on the state to prove otherwise. Florida was the first state to pass a Stand Your Ground law in 2005. Soon after, the American Legislative Exchange Council, also known as ALEC, drafted its own model bill under the name Castle Doctrine Act. ALEC is a private organization that brings together corporations, conservative advocacy groups, and elected officials to advance a legislative agenda. ALEC produces model bills, templates for various bills that are drafted with the input of private interests and introduced into state legislatures around the country by elected officials affiliated with ALEC. Since Florida enacted its Stand Your Ground law, 16 other states have adopted similar bills, and ALEC has taken responsibility for the proliferation. The National Rifle Association is closely affiliated with ALEC, and in 2008, ALEC resident fellow Michael Huff told the NRA News, "ALEC is a very pro-Second Amendment organization. Some of the things that we were pushing in states was the Castle Doctrine." My guest is Brendan Fisher, a law fellow and reporter with the Center for Media and Democracy. Welcome to Uprising, Brendan.
Thank you.
And I should remind our listeners that your organization, Center for Media and Democracy, was the outlet that leaked thousands of drafts of these model bills that ALEC proliferates online last year. We've been covering a number of the model bills since then, and it was just a matter of time, I suppose, that the Stand Your Ground laws and their association with ALEC came to light. How? What is the interest of ALEC to push such laws? Is this essentially because the gun rights movement is so closely affiliated with right-wing politics?
I think that's it. And I think something important to understand about ALEC is that really they're a conduit. They're not a think tank like the Heritage Foundation. They're really a conduit for ideological interests like the NRA or corporate interests like Koch Industries to really push their legislation out through the states. So this Castle Doctrine Act, which is really a misleading name because It goes much further than the common law notion of the Castle Doctrine. This was a bill that was conceived of by the NRA. Reports indicate that an NRA lobbyist actually drafted it. They handed it to Florida legislators and pushed it through the Florida legislature. And then weeks after it passed, that same NRA lobbyist in Florida, Marion Hammer, brought it to the American Legislative Exchange Council and had the corporations and politicians on the ALEC Criminal Justice Task Force approve it. And then it was stamped with the ALEC insignia, and then it became supercharged, and then it spread across the country. So really, ALEC's interest in it is the interest of the NRA. And their ALEC is really just a way that the NRA and other interests can push their interests across the country.
Now, isn't it always true that if one is being attacked and one kills one's attacker, that one has a self-defense justification? Don't people already have that right?
Yes, exactly, exactly. That's something that's in the common law, sort of a basic legal doctrine that's existed for almost as long as our legal system has been around, and that form of self-defense has been codified in a lot of states, and it's very basic, a basic idea that if someone attacks you, you can defend yourself. And the idea of the Castle Doctrine is that if someone attacks you in your home, or if someone is trying to break into your home, then you can respond with force, and that makes sense. But that's a defense from prosecution, which means that if a prosecutor brings charges against you for killing or injuring someone, you can put forward facts saying that I acted in self-defense or I acted according to the Castle Doctrine. But a piece of that is usually that the threat is reasonable and that the use of force is proportional. So if someone takes a swing at you, you can't take out a gun and shoot them. And what this NRA-conceived Castle Doctrine Act, which we're also calling a shoot-first bill, or the Kill It Will bill, it expands the Castle Doctrine to apply outside the home to give immunity to a person who uses deadly force anywhere, basically anywhere they have a right to be, whenever they feel threatened. And then instead of it being a defense against prosecution, it creates a presumption that a person who uses force and claims it's justifiable under the Act is immune from prosecution. So instead of the actor having to put forward facts showing that they acted reasonably and that they acted in self-defense, it puts the burden on the prosecution to prove that the force was not reasonable and the force was not justified. And in a case like Trayvon Martin, what happened between Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman, where there are very few or no eyewitnesses, that can be very difficult to prove. So it basically gives people the ability to respond with force almost whenever they please.
So basically, if nobody's looking, you can kill somebody, say that they threatened you, and you may be walking away a free person.
That's basically what the law does.
Well, it's amazing, and I think a lot of progressives have been caught off guard by these laws, which, as you said, have been sort of supercharged around the country in a number of states because of ALEC's ability to get these laws and whatever model bills they adopt passed. The Stand Your Ground law in Florida is, already and continuing to exonerate people of murder. In Florida, a judge dismissed second-degree murder charges against a man named Grayston Garcia. Garcia saw a man stealing his car radio. He ran out onto the street and chased the thief for about a block or so before stabbing him to death. And the judge essentially reasoned that this man, Grayston Garcia, felt that his life was in danger, even though he chased him and killed a man for stealing a radio. I mean, certainly one has the right to be upset about having one's property stolen, but to kill a man for a radio and then have the state exonerated under this law, what does this mean? I mean, what are the statistics that we're seeing in states like Florida where these homicide statistics, where these laws have passed?
So I've seen statistics saying that since the law passed in 2005, the number of homicides that have been classified as justifiable has tripled. So three times as many incidents where someone has been killed by the act of another. There's no charges being brought. They're classified as justifiable, and the person walks free. And you know, just from what we've seen with Trayvon Martin, the incident with Trayvon Martin, a lot of these are very possibly were not justifiable. The use of force was not proportional. A person's believed, perceived threat was not reasonable. But, you know, they're not bringing charges partly because they just can't, they can't get a prosecution with this law in the books. Mm-hmm. And when this law was being considered, civil rights groups, law enforcement, the district attorney's offices in Florida warned that this would happen. This was not something that the citizens of Florida were clamoring for, and this was not something this was not something that the legislators weren't warned about. They were warned. They were warned that exactly what has happened would happen. But the Florida legislators listened to the NRA rather than their constituents.
Well, I mean, forgive me for sounding incredulous, but what we now have then in states where such laws are adopted essentially have been turned into the Wild West.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and it forces every situation to really escalate, that because you're afraid that someone else might have a gun, and any incident that you get into, they have the right to shoot you, then you get into, then the only way you can really feel safe is if you have a gun too, and if you shoot first. And that's, you know, that's not the kind of society that I think we want to live in.
Now, how do these stand your ground laws sort of dovetail with the NRA's conceal and carry laws that have also been proliferating? So if people can walk around carrying guns legally into all sorts of public places and not have to reveal them, and then these stand your ground laws give them the right to essentially shoot first and claim self-defense later, it seems as though these two laws working in tandem can produce a very dangerous situation almost anywhere.
Yeah, yeah, working together, I mean, it makes all of us less safe and all of us more concerned about what our neighbor is going to do or what the person we pass in the street is going to do. And the NRA has also used ALEC to push these bills across the country. The NRA has proposed a number of ALEC model bills that advocate concealed carry. There's other ALEC model bills that were conceived by the NRA that aim to allow guns on college campuses, aim to reduce the waiting period for getting handguns. And also, you know, the NRA is funded by a lot of firearms manufacturers. So when you get more people owning guns, they make more money. So not only is this an ideological pursuit, but there's also some money to be made off of this.
I'm speaking with Brendan Fisher, a law fellow and reporter with the Center for Media and Democracy. He's just written an article about how ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, does what role it plays in proliferating the Stand Your Ground laws, which in Florida has allowed the killer of Trayvon Martin to go free. What position do these laws put law enforcement in, even perhaps law enforcement who may not agree with these laws? In the case of Trayvon Martin, it seems as though the Sanford police were more than happy to let George Zimmerman walk free, but not all police may agree.
Yeah, and I've actually seen reports that have come out recently that the lead prosecutor in the police department did want to press charges. He didn't want to, you know, claim that Zimmerman was guilty of first-degree murder, but he wanted to press manslaughter charges. But the district attorney's office, because of this law and possibly because of maybe other outside influences, they sent word down that, you know, we don't want to arrest this guy. We can't get a prosecution. So it really ties the hands of both both district attorneys and the police department, because not only does the law set a policy of letting people who shoot another and claim self-defense walk free, but also just they have limited resources. They have to prove that a person who claims self-defense under this law acted unreasonably or did not really feel threatened, and that's a hard thing to do. And the district attorney's offices are overburdened, and they need to really prioritize how they're going to use their resources. So when you have a law like this on the books, which makes it that much harder to get a prosecution, a lot of times they're just going to throw their hands up in the air and say, you know, we just don't have enough resources to really push this case. And that's a real problem, because it allows a lot of people to walk free.
So the police can throw their hands up saying that this law protects them, and then these laws make the perpetrator immune from civil prosecution or civil action.
Yes, yes, and that's another piece of what this law does. So not only does it provide criminal immunity, but you know, in cases like Trayvon Martin's, where you know the prosecutor is not bringing charges, and the family might be inclined to try and achieve some sort of justice by a lawsuit against the individual by you know claiming wrongful death. But this law also provides civil immunity, meaning that the family member of the person killed can't sue for damages. And it even goes beyond that by creating a penalty for a victim who brings a lawsuit against someone who's found to be covered by the law. So not only if you bring a lawsuit and lose, it'll be thrown out of court, but you're also going to have to pay the perpetrator's attorney's fees and costs. So it can actually cost you money to try and achieve justice through the civil justice system.
Now, I understand that California also has a version of the Stand Your Ground law. However, as far as I know, it seems to only strengthen the right to kill someone in your home if you feel like you're threatened. But I'm wondering also, finally, Brendan, how such a law could be used by somebody. For example, we hear a lot of tough-on-crime rhetoric from our elected officials as well. And often when there is, when money is poured into law enforcement, the issue of gang violence is used as a justification. Couldn't somebody who committed a murder, who was identified as part of a gang, use the exact same defense, saying that I felt my life was threatened, so I shot and killed this person first? I mean, couldn't these laws backfire in the faces of the conservatives who pushed them?
Sure, they certainly could. And I think that, I mean, knowing how prosecutors and police departments work, they may not allow that to be invoked, but it does open the door for that possibility.
Sure, and then we'll have to see what the selectiveness of the enforcement is. Brendan, where can listeners get more information about ALEC? Give out the website for the Center for Media and Democracy and how listeners can get access to these model bills.
Sure. So we've posted the over 800 previously secret model ALEC bills on our website, alecexposed.org. So that's A-L-E-C, exposed.org. And then you can read more about the Trayvon Martin shooting and our other investigative reporting on our site, prwatch.org. That's prwatch.org.
alecexposed.org and prwatch.org. Brendan Fisher, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Brendan Fisher is a law fellow and a reporter with the Center for Media and Democracy. We'll post those websites he mentioned on uprisingradio.org later today. We'll also turn next to Mumia Abu-Jamal on the killing of Trayvon Martin. Mumia Abu-Jamal is an award-winning journalist and a political prisoner. After the commentary, we'll hear an interview with Joe Donnelly, former deputy editor at the LA Weekly. He is also now the co-founder and co-editor of Slake magazine, and he's going to be talking to us about an event happening this weekend entitled All In for the 99%. We'll then finally hear from Garrick Ruiz, local activist here in Los Angeles, about the Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions, BDS movement here in Los Angeles that are having an action this Friday. Stay tuned.
Everybody's child. A youngster goes out for a snack, simply something to munch on, and a sweet drink to wash it down with. A man nearby sees him, and suspicion arises. In a matter of moments, the unarmed teenager is dead, and the shooter calmly claims self-defense. The cops come, called by people who witnessed the transaction. They chat with the shooter, perhaps exchange information in the way usually done at a traffic accident. Put in a call to the coroner and leave. Imagine the dialogue. Hey guys, it's self-defense. Yeah, looks like self-defense to me. Yeah, looks like a good shoot. Yep, the kid punched me. Hey, no biggie. Self-defense. Good shoot. You have a good night. No arrest. No real investigation. Case closed for weeks. Now imagine the same events, but with a slight change of place. The shooter is an older, bigger, black man. The teenager is a white rap fan who wears a hoodie. He's unarmed, and he's lying face down in the street. How do you think the cops would have responded then? The fact is, you know how they would have responded. And it wouldn't have taken weeks. It would have taken minutes. Who can doubt this? And what does this say about the system? Everything you need to know. Trayvon Martin is just the name you know now. There are many nameless, faceless Trayvons. And the real tragedy is there will undoubtedly be more. For the system isn't broken. It's rotten. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
You can read all of Mumia Abu-Jamal's commentaries online at prisonradio.org. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. On Saturday, March 31st, a number of leading progressive organizations will come together in Los Angeles to build on the momentum of the Occupy Wall Street movement. Rebuild the Dream, MoveOn.org, Civic Action, Courage Campaign, and the SEIU are hosting All In for the 99%, a day-long event featuring an art exhibit, music, readings, and activist trainings. Among the groups participating in the event are colorofchange.org, presente.org, Communications Workers of America, and Occupy the Dream, with KPFK as the media sponsor. The goal of the event is to, in the words of the organizers, raise awareness of issues that define the 99% movement and demand an end to Citizens United. The art exhibit features works by 80 artists, including Robbie Canal, Kimberly Brooks, Chris Johansson, Shepard Fairey, Cheryl Dunn, and many others. Rebuild the Dream's Van Jones will be present to discuss his new book, and the internet comedy channel Funny or Die will be curating a one-hour film program. Also part of the day-long All In for the 99% event, Slate magazine editors and co-founders Joe Donnelly and Laurie Ochoa will lead a series of readings from their award-winning publication by writers like Erin Aubrey Kaplan and Natasha Vargas Cooper, as well as Val Kilmer reading from his one-man play Citizen Twain, about which he spoke on Uprising yesterday. I spoke with Joe Donnelly about the event All In for the 99% earlier this week. Joe Donnelly is former deputy editor at the LA Weekly, and Slate magazine, which he co-founded and co-edits, is an award-winning new quarterly reader devoted to the endangered art of deeply reported narrative journalism.
Welcome to Uprising, Joe Donnelly.
Hey, how are you?
Doing well. Thanks so much for joining us. The current political climate, given that it's an election year, is an interesting one because it's coming on the heels of the start of what many are considering one of the most important social movements of our time, with the Occupy Wall Street movement and this common identification of Americans thinking of themselves as the 99%. How important is this a time for groups that have already been doing work on the ground, media that have already been active, to come together?
Well, I think it's very important so that the energy and the sentiments that are behind the movement continue to have a focus on them, and also have a means of expression, so that the energy and the momentum can keep going. And I think that's what events like All In for the 99% can help do. They're not necessarily the answer to anything, but they are a way for all these various stakeholders in the 99%, which is, you know, a lot of us, all of us in a way, to come together and, you know, experience the things that bring us together, concern for the future, a desire to have a stake in the future of this country and not be marginalized by the incredible corporate appropriation of our political system.
And so when you have events like this, there are so many dimensions to them. There's going to be readings from your magazine that I want to ask you about, but there's also a whole art aspect of this. This is a major art exhibit, and there's also speakers. There's going to be, you know, just this kind of dialogue, I suppose, that happens. What do you hope for an event like this to generate that builds on the encampments where people were living together in tents around the country, which have now been dismantled?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple of things that I would hope for this Saturday. And I should probably say that the event is free and open to the public this Saturday between 10:30 and 6:30. And it's at 400 South La Brea Avenue. And if you don't mind me saying, Angelinos, come out if you can and get there by 11, and we're going to form a human 99% on the roof of the building, and an aerial photograph will be taken by helicopter. And it's a great symbolic way of showing our support for this movement. But to get to your question, I would hope for a couple things. One, I would hope that the energy that has been behind this this movement will continue to be fueled. The fans will continue to be flamed to keep pushing forward on things like getting, you know, overturning Citizens United and getting the money out of campaigns, and also that the young people who the Occupy Wall Street movement, and most of my experiences with Occupy LA was it really didn't have any identity you could peg it with in terms of gender, age, race, even economic background. From I saw and talked to lots of people who were just fine economically but understood the tremendous pressure that young people coming up were under. And what I hope that we can do is put a face to this for people who actually don't know who the faces and people are that are involved in this, so we can demystify the Occupy movement. That's what I want to do anyway, a little bit, so that people can see that those who are involved in this are just wonderful people, in my experience, caring, beautiful, earnest, and intelligent people. And I hope to bring some of that to the program so that we can actually put real people and insert real people instead of whatever monolithic idea that's been perpetrated by a lot of the mainstream media.
Well,
did
speaking
that make sense, or did I babble?
Sure, no. Well, speaking of the mainstream media, you're somebody who's transitioned to independent media. Tell me about Slake Magazine. You're one of the founding editors, and you're going to be presenting a number of readings, including that of Val Kilmer doing a reading of Citizen Twain, Aaron Aubrey Kaplan, who's been a guest on our program.
Yes, well, my partner, Loria Cho, and I used to work at the LA Weekly. We're the editor and deputy editor, respectively. And, we found ourselves transitioned out of that role and a couple years ago. And, you know, one of our concerns was, how can a city as vital and dynamic as Los Angeles, where can that intellectual and artistic, creative, and political energy go in the sort of vacuum of media that I quite frankly think is worthy of the city? Where can it go? So we tried to start Slake as an answer to that. I'm not sure. I'm not sure we've filled that void, but we're trying to. And we tried to get other people to come on board and invest money with us, and says, we need this. LA needs great publication, needs great media because of how important this city is and how it's at the forefront of a lot of the social and political issues of the 21st century. We had trouble getting the kind of enthusiasm we were hoping for from those who control capital, I guess. So we just said screw it and did it ourselves. Mm-hmm. That's how we found ourselves in independent media. Mm-hmm. This publication that's meant to be quarterly is basically what we were able to do with the resources we have. And we're just really happy about the response and the impact it's having. And it to me, it's indicative that there is a desire for great storytelling in this city and for more in-depth analysis of the issues that we're dealing with.
So the readings that you're presenting at the All In for the 99% event, can you tell us a little bit about that and how they were selected, what they reflect?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Val Kilmer he has a one-man show called Citizen Twain, and as I've joked, Mark Twain was the OG occupier. He's one of America's great political satirists and dissidents and agitators and provocateurs. And I feel like his sentiments would be completely in line with, you know, the Occupy movement. So that's a real blessing that that came together. It just so happened that he was putting up the show as this event was getting together. And Jennifer Gross is one of the producers of the event, so we were able to get him involved. Sam Slavik will be reading from a piece coming up in the next Slake, which should be out any day now. And it's called Big Tent Theory, and Sam spent 2 months on the lawn at City Hall with Occupy LA, and this is his report on his experience there. And we'll also be showing a short screening of his documentary from that experience. And Sam and I have worked together for a long time, going back to the LA Weekly, where we did a series of cover stories on Skid Row and the homeless situation downtown, which was a very impactful and important part of my experience at the LA Weekly, and I know for him as well. Then Erin Aubrey Kaplan, whom you know and are familiar with her work, it kind of speaks for itself. She has a piece coming up in the next issue about a piece of memoir about her experiences growing up in the Crenshaw District and kind of the two steps forward, one step back that she has experienced and witnessed with that neighborhood and you know, the stops and starts that that community has gone through in trying to get onto solid economic footing. And so, you know, all the issues that are involved in Occupy LA or Occupy Wall Street, you know, they're macrocosmic and microcosmic, and you know, she's lived with them for many years and is going to bring that to bear on what she reads. And Vanessa Carlisle will be reading, and she was with the Occupy LA group, and she was there through the whole thing, got arrested, spent 3 days in jail, and wrote about that experience. And she'll be reading for us. And Natasha Vargas Cooper, in this previous issue, War and Peace, we sent her out to Wisconsin to report on the labor issues out there that we're all familiar with and which are an integral part of the formation of the Occupy movement. And, you know, SEIU, she was actually an organizer with SEIU before she became a full-time journalist. And her report for us from Wisconsin became a real real part of the record, the public record on what went down there and what's continuing to go down in Wisconsin and Ohio and Michigan as they try and as the 99% tries to you know, draw a line in the sand. And you know,
I want to mention also that Van Jones will be speaking at the event, and there's also going to be activist trainings in addition to all of the art, et cetera. Well, finally,
let me also mention, too, that we will be introducing several folks who were integral parts of the Occupy LA movement, and we'll be bringing them on stage and, you know, having them introduce themselves and, you know, let people know who they are and why they did what they did, because you know, these are very heroic and brave young people, and I feel like they, you know, they deserve some respect and acknowledgement.
Finally, Joe Donnelly, what do you expect or what do you think this year is going to hold for the Occupy movement, and what do you hope will happen?
That's a very, I'm not sure. What I'm hoping is that the economy doesn't improve enough for everyone to go back to sleep. I'm joking. I mean, I hope it improves enough for people like me who need some money. No, I hope it improves enough so that people aren't getting foreclosed on and can take care of themselves. But the underlying issues that are behind Occupy are real and they're fundamental, and they're very much about what kind of country we want to be, what kind of political system we want to live under, and what kind of democracy we're going to be. And you know, that's really at the root of this, and that isn't going away. When I first started going down Occupy, and I was like, this is the only thing that matters. All the other nonsense like the Republican primary reality TV show is just for, it's just part of commerce. It's just part of capitalism. It's just for to sell ads. It doesn't mean anything. It's not real. But Occupy LA and Occupy Wall Street is real. And we have to, I think we have to do everything we can to make sure that the energy and the ideas and sentiments behind it keep going forward. And, you know, a lot of the entrenched powers are going to do as much as they can to obfuscate and to deny the message and the importance and the issues by saying they don't have an agenda. They don't, but there is an agenda, and the agenda is this system we're under is sick and it's broken, and we need to acknowledge that and go from there. And until we have a consensus on that, which we should have, it's going to be, you know, that's going to be the first step. And I think building a consensus that we actually need to take future in our hands, and we need to make fundamental changes, such as getting all corporate money out of the political system, not giving corporations more rights than people in our democracy. We're not going to get anywhere. We're only edging closer towards plutocracy and actually fascism. You know, so that's what we have to be on guard for, and I think that's what we have to realize this is about. You know, it's about freedom. It's about democracy. It's about having a stake in the future. It's not the opposite of that, which it's being tried to be. People are trying to paint it as, who don't agree with it, who are scared. But don't be scared. That's the message. This is a bright future. This represents a bright future, not a bad future.
Joe Donnelly, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks.
Joe Donnelly is a former deputy editor at the LA Weekly. Slake magazine, which he co-founded and co-edits with Laurie Ochoa, is an award-winning new quarterly reader devoted to the endangered art of deeply reported narrative journalism. The event he's been talking about, All In for the 99%, takes place this Saturday, March 31st, starts at 10:30 in the morning and goes through 6:30 p.m. at 400 South La Brea in Los Angeles. Again, this Saturday, March 31st, from 10:30 a.m. to 6:30 p.m., All In for the 99%, taking place at 400 South La Brea in Los Angeles. For more information, you can visit allinforthe99%.com, allinforthe99%.com, or visit kpfk.org. KPFK is a media sponsor. This is Uprising, and after the short break, we'll take a look at a local movement here in Los Angeles, part of a wider global movement on boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Stay tuned.
KPFK's Spanish language public affairs programming airs from 9 p.m. to midnight every Monday through Thursday. KPFK is the only public radio station in Southern California that broadcasts news and public affairs in Spanish on weekdays. Latinos in Southern California are one of the most influential, politically progressive demographics in the United States. KPFK is the only major broadcast media outlet in the region with Spanish language programming that reflects the politics of this constituency. Tell your friends and neighbors, KPFK's Spanish language programming is on from 9 p.m. to midnight every Monday through Thursday.
La programación en español de KPFK está al aire de 9 a 12 de la noche cada lunes a jueves.
The band The Lo-Fi Friends, based here in Los Angeles. More online about them at lofifriends.com. That's spelled LOFIFRENZ.com. Or check the featured music section of uprisingradio.org later today. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. The United Nations Human Rights Council will launch investigations into human rights abuses in the occupied Palestinian territories after a majority vote approved the decision on Monday. The resolution was passed by 36 of the 47 members. The U.S. was the only member that voted no, with the rest abstaining. The vote drew severe criticisms from Israel and praise from Palestinian officials. The UN decision comes as a worldwide movement to put economic pressure on Israel for its treatment of Palestinians has gained steam in the past several years. The Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions Movement, or BDS for short, began in July 2005 by 171 Palestinian non-governmental organizations seeking to economically pressure companies that do business with Israel and to persuade companies to remove any monetary investments from Israel. BDS is based on a model first used by activists seeking to end the apartheid system in South Africa. One such corporation being targeted by the BDS movement is Veolia, a French utilities and transportation multinational that runs the transit system between Israel and the occupied territories. The transit system is segregated, with buses avoiding Palestinians, traveling over Israeli-only roads, which have been paved over demolished Palestinian homes, and linking illegal settlements in the West Bank to Israel. Veolia also controls the Tovian landfill located on Palestinian land, but which is made for Israeli use only. Local BDS activists here in Los Angeles have targeted this city's Dash bus system, which is run by Veolia through various contracts with LA County. BDS has called for a march and rally on Friday, March 30th, in downtown Los Angeles to protest the city's contracts with Veolia. The event will commemorate both Cesar Chavez Day and Palestinian Land Day, which is a commemoration date of events in 1976 that marks Israel's takeover of large sections of Palestinian lands. Joining me this morning with the BDS movement active here in Los Angeles with a number of movements is Garrick Ruiz. Welcome to Uprising, Garrick.
Thanks so much.
Welcome back to Uprising, I should say. We've had you on about so many different issues that you've been involved in. And this Friday, you're calling on people to honor Cesar and dump Veolia. Well, before we get into why these two are linked, let's talk about Veolia itself, this multinational corporation, which literally is multinational, having contracts in Israel, but also here in Los Angeles County.
That's correct. Veolia is involved in countries around the world, dozens. I believe it may even be over 100 countries. They have contracts, transportation contracts, water contracts, as well as waste management contracts around the world.
And so why is this particular company being targeted? Explain the background of the BDS movement and how the strategy works.
So the movement for boycott, divestment, and sanctions is targeting the apartheid state of Israel. It really focuses on the three different parts of the Palestinian population, right? The call is that to boycott, divest, boycott and divest it from Israel, as well as engage in sanctions on Israel until Israel basically recognizes the rights of all Palestinians. So that means ending the military occupation of the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem. So Palestinians living directly under occupation, military occupation in those locations. Palestinian citizens of the state of Israel who are citizens yet are second-class citizens, so are living under apartheid-like conditions inside the state of Israel as a minority population there. And then the largest segment of the Palestinian population, the refugees, refugees who live some in the West Bank and Gaza, who both are refugees and live under military occupation, but then millions outside in Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, and then around the world in the U.S. and North America, South America, Europe, Asia. The Palestinian diaspora is huge.
And so does that include, does this campaign then also demand the right of these refugees to return?
Absolutely. It's about ending the second-class nature of citizenship of Palestinians in Israel. It's about ending that military occupation and about ensuring the right of return, a right enshrined in international law and with UN Resolution 194 for all Palestinians to be able to return to their homes that they were evicted from in 1948.
Now, the issue of Israel and Palestine is always a contentious issue, but it seems as though this particular campaign, the BDS campaign, Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions, has been particularly targeted by supporters of Israel, but then even people who have been involved with the Palestinian rights movement, like Norman Finkelstein and Noam Chomsky, have critiqued this movement.
They have, and many people have critiqued the movement. Here at the Dump Veolia campaign, the LA Dump Veolia campaign, we take our leadership from Palestinian civil society, from the BDS National Committee, or the BNC, who are the coalition of over 150 groups that issued the initial call for BDS in 2005. We feel that as a solidarity organization, our place is to take that leadership for how Palestinians would like us to support them internationally. And they have called through the call from 2005 for BDS as a nonviolent tactic that international solidarity activists can utilize. And I think it's been utilized very effectively. Veolia, probably the highlight campaign, but there have been many different campaigns targeting corporations that profit from the occupation, profit from apartheid.
It seems as though this is a very sort of multi-pronged campaign, because on the one hand, you have specific corporations that are targeted, like Veolia, and then you also have entities, institutions, and even businesses that can choose to or have battled over whether or not to choose to participate in the boycott. One issue that comes to mind just this week is the news of a food co-op in New York, the Park Slope Food Co-op, that were going to consider whether or not to vote to adopt the BDS campaign, but there was a lot of controversy, and then they chose to not take that vote. So how widespread is this campaign, and what sort of successes can you attribute to it?
This campaign has been huge internationally. And so let me take a couple of different ways of talking about the successes. One, I'm not totally familiar with the Park Slope Co-op situation. Mm-hmm. But I think one thing that's important to note is that even when these initiatives are defeated, as in that case, it brings up the issue in a big way and is a way to educate people. What I would say as a difference, right, is that the Olympia Food Co-op in Washington State in the last year actually decided to boycott Israeli goods and to remove Israeli goods from their shelves. They were actually taken to court by Israeli-backed, you know, forces in the U.S. And the judge threw out the idea that this co-op could not decide to boycott and upheld the right of people to boycott a tactic that has been used over and over and over again in social justice struggles, mm-hmm. right? Not just with South Africa, which is where the BDS movement takes most of its leadership from, but also by forces such as the United Farm Workers, Cesar Chavez, with the Great Boycott here in California, as well as the civil rights struggle with Rosa Parks and the Montgomery bus boycott. So this tactic has been used successfully in many different movements. The other thing I would just mention is around Veolia specifically. As I said, this has been one of the main focuses of the international movement. And they have been under intense pressure and been feeling the economic heat because of this international movement. They lost a contract for the city of Stockholm's public transportation system. They had had that contract for 10 years. Yeah. And they lost that contract, which was worth over $4 billion.
Because of the BDS movement?
You know, in most of these situations, it's hard to say that exactly, because usually when the legislatures involved vote, they don't say we did this because of, you know, Israeli human rights violations. However, in that case, the Church of Sweden and many other forces lobbied intensely to get that contract removed because of the international BDS movement. And the same in cities such as Tehran and in Iran, where a contract was lost after pressure was placed. In Melbourne, Australia, same thing. Veolia is feeling this pressure. And even just in this past week in Hastings in the UK, again, they were excluded from a bidding process after a successful BDS campaign there.
And so you're hoping to bring that success here to Los Angeles, where Veolia runs the city's Dash bus system. It has a number of contracts with LA County. Let's talk about this event on Friday, which is also a global day of action for boycott, divestment, and sanctions on Israel. The event that is happening in downtown LA is on Friday, March 30th, and there will be a 3 p.m. rally on the corner of North Spring and College College in downtown LA, followed by a march to City Hall. The rally will happen at 4:30 at City Hall on the Spring Street steps. It's a rally that's being called Honor Cesar, Dump Veolia. And the obvious connection, which you alluded to earlier, is that Cesar Chavez leading the great grape boycott here in California. You see the BDS movement and this targeting of Veolia in the same vein as that?
Absolutely. As longtime activists here in Los Angeles and in the state of California, when we heard the international call for March 30th, which is Palestinian Land Day, when we heard this international call, we immediately connected March 31st, the day after, as being Cesar Chavez's birthday, right? And so we feel it's extremely important to connect these histories of struggle, these histories of resistance that people around the world have taken, right? Obviously, as we've talked about, the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement takes a lot of example from the struggle against apartheid South Africa. But we believe it's important to connect to all these movements. And the one other thing I would just say, just to make sure people are aware, is that Palestinian Land Day is called that because in 1976, on that day, six Palestinian citizens of Israel, again, these are Palestinians who live in Israel, have citizenship, right, were killed by Israeli security forces, were shot and killed by Israeli security forces, as well as many, many other Palestinians in Israel injured, protesting the theft of their land within Israel itself, not even talking about the military occupation. Mm.
So, Garrick Ruiz, what do you want the city to do then, the city and the county? Who exactly are you targeting? Are you going to be targeting specifically the county through the Board of Supervisors, but your rally is happening in front of City Hall?
No, actually. So the first part of the rally at North Spring and North Spring and College, is in front of a Veolia bus yard. Mm. So Veolia, as a subcontractor to the city of Los Angeles, has several bus yards. This is one of them. So first, we're going to go directly to Veolia. Then we're marching to City Hall. And the reason is because these contracts with the Dash bus system are actually through the LA City Department of Transportation. So we're really asking the city to stand up for justice, to actually stand up in its own tradition of justice, right? Los Angeles was the first large city in the U.S. to divest from South Africa as a city.
Mm. So L.A. has an amazing history.
And so we're really asking Los Angeles to follow in that history, to be consistent and cancel these contracts with Veolia, this corporation that has that is clearly profiting from apartheid and from the occupation. And you mentioned, I think briefly, but just to reiterate for listeners, Veolia helped to build light rail connecting illegal settlements in East Jerusalem to West Jerusalem. They, because of the international movement, and I think this is a sign of success, right, have announced that they're pulling out of that particular project. Now, what they're saying is that they're going to pull out slowly over 5 years. So Palestinians are saying, you know, regardless, they're still profiting. You know, they need to be out right now. But also, in addition to that light rail, Veolia runs segregated buses that you alluded to. These are buses that run from Israel proper into the West Bank on Israeli-only roads. Some of them have parts of the route where Palestinians can ride, but all and some have no parts. Some are just Israeli-only routes, but then all have areas where Palestinians are not allowed to be. So clear segregation in the bus system. And then they also own and operate the Tovlon landfill, which is in the Jordan Valley and on the West Bank, actually deep in the West Bank. And it's a landfill that services settlements. So settler trash, you know, from these illegal Israeli settlements is then taken to a landfill, again, still on occupied territory, and Veolia makes money off of this process. Mm.
So here in Los Angeles, you are calling on the city to dump Veolia. Give out the information again, and is there a website or email address that people can go to find out more about Friday's event?
Absolutely. To get in touch with us directly, please email us at dumpveolia.la@gmail.com. That's dumpveolia@gmail.com. Also, I would highly recommend people to take a look at the international BDS website, which is bdsmovement.net. That's bdsmovement.net. We hear that the Dump Veolia campaign is a relatively new initiative here in the city of Los Angeles, and we're working on our own website. But for now, the best way to get in touch with us is that email address.
That's dumpveolia.la@gmail.com. The website for the national movement is, or international movement, is bdsmovement.net. Garrick Ruiz, best of luck to you. I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
First and only subversive thought for the day. Eleanor Roosevelt once said, justice cannot be for one side alone, but must be for both. That's Sonali's subversive thought for the day. Again, the event is happening Friday, March 30th. The rally will happen on the corner of North Spring and College in downtown LA. There'll be a march to City Hall, followed by another rally in front of City Hall at 4:30 p.m. You can check all the details on uprisingradio.org. You've been listening to Uprising. Martina Steiner is our assistant producer. Leonardo Alanis is our intern. Chris Bennett is our music curator, and Teddy Robinson is our engineer. Visit us online at uprisingradio.org, where you can listen to all of our interviews, rate them, leave comments, share them on Facebook, and find links and events we mention on the air. Send your story ideas to mail@uprisingradio.org. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow at 8.